This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. Jack Brighton, the producer for the show, Brian Wagner at the controls. We're very pleased to have with us this morning a special guest visiting to, in a way, help us celebrate the anniversary of All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne is with us, and certainly you will know her voice. She has hosted both All Things Considered and Morning Edition. She's now a correspondent. It also sometimes serves as a substitute host. She has been involved with public radio for quite a while. She, as well as hosting the magazines, she did some reporting for NPR from South Africa. In 1990, she was there to cover Nelson Mandela's release from prison. She also spent then a couple of other years there reporting, and in fact was part of a team that was sent to cover the elections there, and the coverage provided by that team won an Alfred DuPont Columbia Award. So that's prestigious. She also then, before that, worked in New York. She was an independent producer for and reporter for NPR. She also did some work for the CBC. And before that, she was a reporter and editor for Pacific News Service in San Francisco. She's making a whirlwind tour here through central Illinois. We've got her for a couple of hours. The poor woman's going to be completely exhausted by the time that she gets home. But we're pleased to have her here in the studio. If you have questions about public radio, about journalism, about the way they do things at NPR, any and all of that is certainly welcome. All you have to do, pick up the telephone and dial the number. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that one, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. Here, I'm getting used to this microphone right here. Let's see. I don't want to pop my peas. But thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
How did you get involved in doing radio in the first place?
I backed into doing radio. I think possibly because a lot of us at NPR are so committed, and I use that word advisedly. We're so committed to being at public radio. It might seem that all of us came in with a kind of starry-eyed, I want to work for public radio. I want to do something great. And a lot of my colleagues, in fact, had that in mind. I myself can't be counted in that number. It's sort of in a roundabout way ended up in public radio. I went to University of California, Berkeley. I'm from California. So it was my local, university. And the last year of college, word got out amongst my friends who were not journalists or were not aiming to be journalists, we're all students, but were writers and poets and wanted to be those, that kind of thing, that there was this little community radio station that had just started up in San Francisco and was called KPOO, those were its call letters, which came to stand for Poor People's Radio. So you can imagine how appealing it was for me in college to go over there. It was poor in one sense. There was very there was nobody who was making any money. It was like a strictly volunteer effort, but it was exciting. It was really exciting. You could go over there. You could get a program. People who were interested in music got themselves music programs. My one friend who was a poet put herself on, and she named her show the Original Aboriginal Dancing Girl, and she ended up writing a series of poems that came to pulled together and ended up on Broadway actually about 2 years later when she was still quite young. I created a show called, and this was not the most inventive name, but it was called Women's Voices. I mean, I cringe now that I think about, couldn't I have come up with something better? But anyway, it was the notion was it was a women's show talking, about women, two women, bringing women into the studio. I mean, we probably had fewer listeners than we had people volunteering for that station. I mean, it was San Francisco, which is a hilly place. It was a weak FM signal. Hmm. But, I fell in love with the medium and the intimacy of it. And it wasn't until much later that I imagined myself, once I was actually working for NPR, I fully thought, this is really what I love to do. This is really how I love to communicate. But, in those first days, what I did discover, though, was I liked the sort of intimacy. It's like there's an audience, but it doesn't matter what size it is. You're talking. You always seem to be talking to one person, or maybe a couple of people. If Morning Edition, when I host it, sometimes people have asked me, gosh, does that make you nervous going on the air with Morning Edition? I mean, you know, there over a week, there's 10 million people at any given time. There's these days quite a few people. Well, partly because I'm so used to being on radio where there was probably 10 people listening way back. And also partly because the medium is such, you don't ever feel like you're speaking to those numbers. And I'm even as I sit here right now and listen to myself and you in our headsets, it just reminds me, I often think of radio as like a telephone conversation. Mm-hmm. And you know how intimate that is and how people say things that are important. You know, how you get on the telephone and you can really block out the rest of the world and focus in on that person. So, you know, as strictly as a medium, I'm not talking about exactly the journalism part of it, which we're pretty proud of, but and are always watching, you know, how we do. Just the actual physical medium. It came to me sort of, as I say, in a roundabout way. I tell you, when I was in college, I can't tell you how unlikely, if somebody had said, oh, you're going to end up in radio, I would have, radio, what's that? But I will say one last thing is, I don't think of NPR or PRI, Public Radio International, or our stations. I don't think of public radio exactly as radio in the larger sense. I think what we do is so different, it's almost not in the same category as commercial radio. Hmm. And I don't even mean so much better, literally, although I like to think it's better. I just think it's different.
Just really different. Well, I think that that's true. And I think, during the time that I've been working in radio, people, I don't think they say that anymore, but there was a time that people were asking the question, will radio survive? And it's that seems kind of strange now, the idea that radio, particularly AM radio, would be gone, that it'd be eclipsed by television or something else. And I think what you say is true. There's something about it that is special to radio. And I don't know about you, but I had this experience. I'm sure a lot of other people had the experience when they were kids, listening to the radio in bed at night with the lights off. Mm-hmm. And there is something about it that's like whispering in somebody's ear, which is very much what it is you're doing. And the people use it differently from television. I think it is a companionship medium. We talk about that all the time. And because of that, I think nothing can take its place. There won't be anything like it.
Well, I'll tell you something, too, about the whole demise of radio. First of all, it was on the downward slope, I mean, in the late 60s. It wasn't, listenership was on the going down. And when public radio came along, so it was sort of a new thing. I mean, not public. This station, of course, is 80 years old. So we're not talking about all at any given place. But I'm talking about as a national concept, there was no public radio nationally. There were whole states. I mean, I went to Texas to do a story in the late 80s, and there were not enough stations to keep going. You know,
there were states that didn't have any public radio at all.
Western Nebraska, I guess, because my mother's family's from there. They didn't have my uncles used to try and listen, and they couldn't because they knew what I did, but they could never get me in. And that was again also just in the 80s. But AM, the numbers in commercial AM are going down now, but they're not. I mean, there are not so many AM stations, obviously, in the public radio system, but not here. I mean, not in this milieu. I was going to say, though, you're talking about listening in the dark. We got a lot of letters after September 11th, a lot of email from listeners. It was just the time for listeners to write us and share their experiences, which is a very very public radio thing. It wasn't people writing in to complain. It wasn't people writing in to praise, although there were some complaints and a lot of praise, more or less to share their experiences. And one of the letters was from a woman in California who wrote in that when she turned on the television, like virtually everybody did who was near a television that day, and at a certain point, on the one hand, it was like she had to look, but she had to look away. It was this moment of, I can't take it. I've seen the airplane crash now 19 times, and I just can't. I've got it memorized. Anyway, she wrote us that she left the television on but hit the mute button and put on her Walkman and tuned in to the NPR, which was having special coverage, turned into her station there in California, and listened to NPR watching the various pictures on the television. And I guess thought got the best of both worlds. But, she turned to radio. And if I got the impression, my impression was she was walking around and out of sight of the TV quite a bit of the time. And just to get, as she said, to get some more depth, some more feeling, some more, to be in touch. Because you get the impression with listeners, which I would hope, I guess we'll be hearing from some, you know, to stay in touch, it was like family. The way everyone called around, you know, people wrote us and people tuned to us. And it was like a soothing sort of thing, I think, for a lot of people.
Our guest this morning here in this part of Focus 580 is Renee Montaigne. She is a correspondent for National Public Radio. She's hosted both All Things Considered and Morning Edition and is visiting us. And if you have questions about public radio or about journalism or about anything else, you can call in here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Hearing you talk about when you started out working at the community station in San Francisco makes me think of some of the things that one reads, and you see it over and over again. I was just recently reading a piece that somebody wrote for Salon. And people who have that kind of memory and who remember what public radio was like in the early days now often lament its present condition because they say that it has become too mainstream, too frivolous. They don't like all the underwriting. They somehow think that we are enthralled to the people who are making those contributions in order to get the honor mentions. And they're still looking for the kinds of programs that you used to do and probably a lot of people used to do. And on some community stations, they do still do. And, you know, they're not real happy with NPR as it is today, in spite of the fact that a lot of people think we're doing a pretty good job, and the audience has grown substantially. So when you hear those kinds of comments from people about the good old days and about how it used to be more interesting and more adventurous and more of an alternative, and they say now that today, public radio is just like the rest of the media, how do you respond to that?
Well, okay, within the organization there's a joke, and it's sort of a standing joke for the last long as I can remember, 15 years, that the golden age of NPR, and the golden age of NPR was 6 months before you got there. Yeah, you know, I mean, and that would be, I think, most, we all recognize that things were always better in the sort of dim mist of, you know, the past. I think there's merit to some concern that there was more, that's concern that would, you know, that NPR, now that it is a more mature, now I'm just speaking about NPR News because that's what I know about, but NPR News is a mature news organization, and I mean that in as an entity. But also, if you get right down to it, many of the people that came to NPR, Linda Wertheimer was there day one, Susan was there day one, Susan Stamberg. I wasn't there. You know, if you think of NPR Generations as every 10 years, I came in the second group, the second wave. But most of us came there in our 20s. Early 20s, some of us. Ira Glass, who does the show This American Life, he showed up as an 18-year-old intern. He was still at Brown University. You know, and a lot of us, Neil Conan, although he didn't start at NPR, amazingly, he's so smart. I believe he left college and was working as a very young person at a Pacifica radio station, but quickly came over to NPR. So, you know, a lot of we've matured in the real physical sense. The people who run NPR are now, used to be in their 20s and then got into their 30s and now are going into their 50s. And, you know, that, you know, what is that? You know, nothing like a mortgage and kids to make you seem more, what it might be, less risk, more risk averse, I suppose, in a deep way. But I don't go along with the idea, to put it straight, that it's gotten worse. I think it's changed. I think you know change is inevitable, and it's more or less good. In order to reach a larger public, when I came there, I'm sorry, I'm sort of getting off the track here, but I will say this: I had to listen, It was a pleasure. I listened to the first weeks of NPR's programming, which I had never done. The first weeks in that May of 1971, when I did a tribute to Susan Stamberg. And last spring. And it was kind of a trick. I was asked to do it, and I said, sure, I'd do it, but under the conditions that I could do it any way I wanted to. And the one way I didn't want to do it, which seemed to be the obvious way, was to go back and actually, it was going to be a surprise. She wasn't really going to hear. And in fact, we managed to keep her in the dark till her husband, Lou, turned on the radio that morning. But You know, the obvious way to do it might be to go around asking people to just basically say nice things about Susan, or I remember the day, you know, and I just couldn't do that. So I thought, well, let's just play what she did, you know. And then besides that, I wanted to interview the cartoonist in The New Yorker, who had done a cartoon that I'd seen years ago and had seen on the wall for a while. So that showed, it was a New Yorker cartoon, turned out to be from 1978. And I'll tell you the cartoon, because the fact that it's not as funny now as it was then will say something about how we've changed. And what it was this. It was a guy in a tweed jacket, typical New Yorker, sophisticated guy in his apartment, probably in New York City, in a tweed jacket, leaning back, little martini sitting next to him. He had a beard, which would have signaled intellectual or hoping to be, you know. And Pickett had his book in front of him, and his wife is on the phone, holding the phone, and she's doing the talking. And the I don't have it in front of me, but essentially the joke line was, "It's Susan Stamberg on the phone. She wants your opinion on the state of the world."
Oh, I thought it was, she wants to know if you want to defend yourself on the national airwaves.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. That's exactly what it was. She wants to know if you want to defend yourself on the national airwaves. But the gist almost was, you know, what's your opinion? What's your point? And it was funny. It was a giggle line at the time, because at the time, what mostly All Things Considered was doing, and Susan was obviously iconic. She wasn't going to get a New York Times for nothing. And a little bit of a well-kept secret. That's also The New Yorker. That's also like the New Yorker thing, you know, like, well, we know about it, but not necessarily the rest of them out there. She, the joke was that anybody in the country could have been sitting there leaning back, relaxing and ready to have their martini, and Susan would call and would call and kind of quiz them a little hard on things, because she was very good at that. You know, "I don't believe that," she would say. "Oh, no, you're kidding me. You don't really mean that, do you?" But she managed to say in this great Susan-esque way, you know, like like she's embracing you at the same time. But what my point is the reason she we called out, though, and the reason that it isn't so funny today, because you don't expect to get a phone call, you know, really. You don't expect actually Robert Siegel to call you and ask you to defend your position on the airwaves, which is, one could look at that as a sad thing, like, well, what a shame, things have changed. Now they have reporters all over the place and commentators, and the 2 hours just packed chock full of experts of one sort or another. On the other hand, the reason Susan called out, and as far as I'm concerned, as I understand it, virtually created the notion of calling out, because if you think about it, talk shows have always existed. People have always called in. But if you can name for me, because we couldn't figure at the time last spring, we couldn't find another one, nobody called out. No, you know, I'm waiting for somebody to come up with so-and-so
really,
who did that.
With all due respect to the National Public Radio, I do think that the CBC was doing that.
Oh, I mean in America.
First. Oh, in
no,
America.
No, I'm not saying it had never happened
absolutely.
In life.
Absolutely. No.
In America, radio.
Nobody. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Yeah,
they might have borrowed it from the CBC.
I think
there was a lot of influence by the CBC on the early days. No, I absolutely agree with you. Or the BBC, for all I know. But the CBC had a show called As It Happens, and NPR borrowed some of the elements of that show. I don't mean NPR. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say invented. Maybe that's a bad word, but essentially introduced the American public to that. But the reason we did it wasn't just philosophical, although with Susan it was. She really believed in that and does believe in that. But it was that we didn't have any reporters. When I first came in 1980, there were five. I can name you the reporters. Five reporters domestically, and there was one guy, Robert Siegel, in London. That was it. That was our throw weight out there in the world of journalism. So you wanted to get a story. There were a lot of. I was a freelancer for years. A lot of freelancers, people who had like jobs as waitresses on the side to pay the bills, and you know, we all believed in it. That was great. And on one level, sure, we were experimenting. On another level, we were learning. So if you listen back to those old shows, you can hear some really intriguing things, and you can hear some stuff that is embarrassing.
Sure.
And you wouldn't put it on the air. 12-minute stories about things that, you know, you could say in five, really. And you could say better if you knew what you were doing.
And that's where, all of us who work in public radio, that's the way we learned, because we listened to what you guys were doing, and then we tried to copy. We tried to copy it. And I'm sure that we also did some pretty embarrassing stuff. I'm really glad there are not tapes around of me. Because before we actually cobbled together a morning magazine that we were doing here for a while before there was Morning Edition. And we were desperate to put stuff on. And we basically had two hosts, and we had an executive producer who was the news director, and we had a guy who did the morning news, and that was it. And we ripped stuff off from everywhere. We reran stuff from All Things Considered. We did our own features, but we tried to make it sound like All Things Considered. So I'm sure that that's what, because there was no real way to learn how to do it. You just had to do it and try to make it sound like the national product, which is the way I guess we really all learned.
Yeah, you know, that's so funny you said that, because I just said that earlier today. I was saying I am so glad that we were so poor in these radio stations that nobody ever taped anything, that there's no evidence of the terrible stuff I was doing in those first years. Listeners loved it. I mean, there was something down and rough and dirty almost about what we were doing. People loved it. So I understand why sometimes people say, back then. But I think whatever the trade-off is for us, all the stations that are also better, and you know, the money has to come from somewhere if you want to talk about underwriting. I do think that's an issue there. I think it's something all of stations, which are the ones, as you know, that really have to deal more or less with these public radio version of advertising, you know, they have to make choices. And I would guess listeners should be weighing in to the individual stations. I mean, I have heard stations in the country that, you know, I've heard things that sound like straight up and down ads.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's but because stations are listener supported and the most of the money comes from listeners. I mean, my experience is, and I bet it's yours too, that there is a real sensation that you get from listeners. I'm a listener. Listen, I subscribe to two stations in Los Angeles. You get, and I'm sending money to WNYC, by the way, too, because they lost their transmitter at the World Trade Center when it fell.
Yeah.
I get the impression listeners know those subscribers, the 1 in 10 who listens that subscribes, they feel like the station belongs to them. So I feel like it's up to them, you know, to make the argument to the station that they belong to and own at the same time that, you know, this is going too far, or, you know, I feel like I'm hearing ads, or there's too much underwriting, or I think that one little thing you said. But and then beyond that, I think the trade-off in the programming, is good. I mean, the trade-off in us having now, I don't know, 6 reporters in the region of near Afghanistan, when in 10 years ago, we would have been lucky to get, well, we might have brought everybody out of the domestic bureau and sent them over there. But I mean, to have 6 people who are normally based near there, you know, that's a big thing for us. And it's new in the last decade. Yeah. And I think it's very good for listeners.
Well, I do honestly believe that if you took, you went back and you took an old All Things Considered show, as good as it might have been, and play it for people, and then set that aside a show, you know, yesterday, and you asked them, okay, which one of these shows do you think was better? I honestly believe that they would say yesterday's show in many respects was a much better program in terms of content, the amount of information that's available, the polish
with which it's put together.
They might say, well, I could see some kind of cool things about the old show, and I really appreciate what they did and all, but I don't really think that they would trade today's shows. They would want to go back. Now, that's also not to say that there's not room for spontaneity and doing unusual things and, the kinds of things that used to be more common.
Yeah. Oh, no. And believe me, if I've made it seem like nobody thinks about that, there's an ongoing dialogue about making the shows, the two main shows, which, you know, to keeping them from becoming calcified. I mean, you know, making them more. And it's, you know, like I say, it's hard. I mean, the hosts have been there for long time now, and All Things Considered. I mean, I hosted that show for 2 years, and when I took it over with Robert Siegel in 1986, Susan had been on at that time for 16 years, which seemed like a lifetime, and she was, you know, retiring, as it were. Not really. She was going to another show, but her own show on Sunday morning. But, you know, the host there now, if you, I guess, count Robert in, Robert's been there for 15 years now, and Linda's been there for about 13, and Noah, because he came back, gosh, he's been there longer than all of them. So, I mean, I think that's a natural, and it's a concern everybody has, including them. You know, like, how can we keep it fresh? How can we, and still be the same people who've been there? And I'm going to a retreat. I'm leaving here this afternoon to go to what's a retreat, first ever for Morning Edition tomorrow. The entire staff will be there. Bob Edwards, of course, too. poor thing, because he works so hard. I mean, seriously, to ask him to come in on a Saturday all day. I mean, the hours he keeps, I keep them when I do his job, but he keeps them all the time. And they're just killer hours. And, you know, when he has time to sleep or have a family, and he has three kids, I actually don't know. I can't figure it out. But anyway, we're having this get together, and its sole aim, sole purpose is to figure out how to breathe fresh life and maintain creativity on Morning Edition. It's the only reason we're getting together, because people feel fine about the news part. Mm-hmm. You know, we know what we're doing right. So, you know, and it was called about 6 months ago and organized about 6 months ago for just that reason. Because so if anybody, you know, for what it's worth, it's a, you know, NPR, we're thinking about it, you know, as an issue, the keeping the old, the good things from the old days and still getting bigger, because we want to get bigger.
Yeah. When Morning Edition started, it sounded as if there was a fairly deliberate effort to pattern it after All Things Considered. There were two hosts that, for one reason or another, I don't know, that didn't work out. And then Bob was called in to, because they needed somebody, and that was supposed to be temporary, and now he's still there. The two programs do definitely have different personalities, so they did evolve in different ways. As you think about it, what's the difference between Morning Edition and All Things Considered? What are the important differences?
Well, you know, I think anybody who thinks about it could figure out that, you know, if you sort of think it through, people relate to news and information differently in the morning than they do in the afternoon. I'm not saying every single person on the planet, but the average person wants to hear a somewhat different tone in the morning, you know, when you're waking up, than what you're ready to hear or would like to hear in the afternoon. And so morning has always been viewed, it was actually not designed exactly to be like All Things Considered, at least by the time, you're right, there were two hosts who, I don't know how they worked out these things. They never got on the air. They hired two hosts who've gone on to do perfectly nice things in other places. And they fired them, basically, which is kind of weird with NPR. And then Bob, it is a good joke. The joke is Bob and Susan were the two hosts of All Things Considered. And they said to Bob, if you'll just do this for 6 months, you know, then you can go back. You know, mm-hmm. You have to do us a favor because listeners know you. And, you know, I guess it's a little true on TV, but it's definitely true in radio. If you get to know somebody, it is this intimate medium. And, you know, you feel better about the person as time goes on, more or less. And people know you. You've been host. You're the host of the other big show. And, you know, and we'll spring you back. And then, of course, Bob is like, and I'm still there. But, of course, that is the joke because Bob is, you know, is the heart and soul of that show. I think in the morning, people, we're very well of this. The clock, it's called a clock. The shows have clocks. And Morning Edition has always been 2 hours, All Things Considered, for most of its life. For the first 20 years was, or 26 years was, or whatever, 4 years, was a 90-minute show. And that had I know, because I hosted that show, it had a very different rhythm. You said good evening at the beginning, and you said good, what do we say at the night? Good night. I don't know, at the end. And people, they decided to stop that around the time I came to host it, much to Susan's chagrin. I know that. But there was actually a reason, and a good one. I was from the West Coast originally, and I used to always be back. The show used to start in the middle of the show on the West Coast. You know, it was a 90-minute show, and as it cycled through and it hit the West Coast, you wouldn't hear the first words would be good evening. You'd hear the credits at the end of the first half hour, like, goodbye, see you, it's been swell. And then you'd hear good evening at the beginning of the next. Or my mother once said, I really like it how you do all those long pieces right at the beginning. Because it would depend on when the station in question would pick the show up. But they could pick up any of the half hours. So it was like a way of honoring the fact that we were a national organization and that we were not based, nice as it was to have a 90-minute show where you said hello and goodbye. Okay, Morning Edition was always 2 hours and was always broken up into much smaller bits, whether... I don't know if you all out there, you know, listeners know this, but you'll probably recognize it when I say it. There's no piece longer than 8.5 minutes on Morning Edition, and it's a very tight, these are very tight segments. You can go for that, I won't name them all, but there's an A, a B, a C, a D, and an E, and each has a certain time, 8 minutes, 7.5 minutes, 3 minutes, 8.5, and 7. And the idea is to vary the texture, but also to give stations a way out of the show to give you weather, traffic, You know, all kinds local of little news. Local news, yeah. All kinds of things. They never fashioned All Things Considered. I call it ATC. We call it ATC. All Things Considered was never meant to do that. In fact, there were struggles, which you will remember probably, about giving opening out the show at all, anything short of a half an hour. It was at every half hour. It was like, okay, hello, everybody out there locally. But and then there was this. Finally, there's been enough pressure because the stations needed to get out and do traffic, weather, and what. That now there are these breaks during All Things Considered. But the idea was the afternoon show was more intense, more in depth. You could take a whole half hour. You know, they could do a small documentary. Mm-hmm. You could turn it into, they didn't do talk, but you know, you could turn it into one long conversation if you wanted, and that people would tune in with at the end of their day, reasonably relaxed, willing to pay attention, but that in the morning you couldn't keep their attention for more than 8.5 minutes. People are brushing their teeth, they're running around, and you know, it's in that sense, it's a very different show. The one host might not have happened. They might have had two hosts. But it was faster, and now I think it's really excellent. In the future, who knows? I mean, you know, Bob's been there 25 years, you know. But I was going to say, one host sort of works for the morning to my ears as a listener in the morning because, there's so much else going on. The local people come in, there's traffic, there's this, there are co-hosts locally. So it might not seem on the face of it so different. Also, we have different ways of, stories that can go. We do sad stories in the morning. But there are actually certain words you don't say or certain concepts, things that are a little grisly. I did something that'll show up on Monday morning that I had to refer to a song. I'm doing a piece on narco corridos, and corridos are traditional ballads.
I read about there was a piece in the New York Times.
Just recently?
Recently.
Darn, they be. Well, yeah. I've had this interview for about 2 weeks, but it takes a while, and we finally got it together, and then I was coming out here, so we put it together on Wednesday, and it'll show up on Monday. Corridos, they are. And I was just talking about one kind of new thing that happened in the 90s and how they got quite grisly. And what is it? How late is it today? I guess I can say it now. It's 11 something.
It's after 11:30.
Okay, well, I was going to say, and one song, I'll try and say it as decently as I can. One song, actually, in translation, was about some guy. These are like gangster rap songs, in a way. You know, that kind of element, that kind of topic and subject matter. And the guy was like about a guy who was shot out in the desert and his, guts fell out over the desert. Well, the guy translated it. It was gruesome. So I said about what I've just said, because we just couldn't let the translation go on the air. Whereas I think you probably could have put it on the air at 6 at night. You wouldn't want to catch somebody at dinner, but, catching people at breakfast is much, much worse. So those are just a few little ways, but there are a lot of differences, I think.
We're a bit past the midpoint here of this part of Focus 580, talking with Renee Montaigne from National Public Radio. She's hosted both All Things Considered and Morning Edition. Has also worked as a reporter. She's been involved in public radio for, about 20 years? Years?
21, 21.
And is visiting the station here. We're happy to have her. And if you have questions, we do have somebody here ready to go. Others are welcome in Champaign-Urbana, where we are 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. The caller here is Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, David and Ray.
Hello.
Yes, I heard about your show because the All Things Considered show because a couple of friends of mine were telling me about it. I'm a visually impaired and we consider your show sort of the our magazine, and they were saying you have to listen to the show because they just recently did a piece on the Tuskegee Airmen, and that was back in 1971. So I thought, well, why not tune it in? And I've been listening ever since. I enjoy the program. I just thought you'd like to know. When you do this piece on Monday, will there be a warning before it? Since this song is so graphic, will there be a warning that if you want to opt out, you can opt out?
Well, we do. I guess that we do warnings about certain things. As we send out to the stations, and occasionally you put it in a script. But mostly if we allow the station to opt out if there's a. But what I was saying was that we didn't. The music that will be heard will not be that part in Spanish.
Oh, right.
And the English translation, because I just thought it's not that important, and I just verbalized it in my script. But in the actual interview, the guy said it in this way that was just, hard to take too early in the day. And I just said, this is my choice. I said, yes, it was a graphic. I said what I've just said just now. I said it was a graphic story about somebody who's, guts. You can hear that gut spilled out in the desert, especially coming out of my mouth. But hearing it in the song and then hearing this guy say it in a very particular way.
Yeah, I think if someone is eating breakfast, that might be a little hard.
Oh, yeah. We're very aware of that, though. I mean, like I said, it's hard. And kids tend to be more listening in the morning, little kids. There are a lot of elements about how radio is listened to in the morning that are different than they are in the afternoon.
Yeah, remember, you're NPR, not HBO, so that's...
Oh, yeah, we do. Our producer, our executive producer, her name's Ellen McDonald. She's very, she has little kids, and she's like the, you know, she is actually very kind of careful about that. She's like the mom's point of view.
Yeah.
I mean, so some of this is on the fly, as you can imagine. Some of this is just our sensibility, but we think we're reasonably at one with listeners. Not always, though.
Yeah, listen, if you'll excuse me for a minute, can I ask David a question?
Sure.
David, I noticed that on Sunday you used to bring a lot of stuff from the CBC Sunday
mm-hmm.
morning before
mm-hmm.
after the Sunday morning show with, Leanne Hansen. And, well, I don't know if she was doing it back then. I don't know if she was doing it then. But I know she stopped doing that, and I just wondered why. They used to bring a lot of some good stuff.
It's because, first of all, the program that we used to run, the Sunday morning program produced by the CBC, they went out of business.
Oh, I see.
And now what they do at the CBC is they have a morning show, and I think the name of the program is This Morning, that runs Monday through Friday. And it's a magazine show. It's not unlike Morning Edition, although they do a lot of longer interviews. They may do an entire segment devoted to a particular person or a subject.
Well, and you can't exactly run that, though.
No. And then what they do on the weekend is they repackage some of that material, and then on CBC on Sunday, what you hear is like a best of This Morning program. And I don't think that any of that now is available to public stations in this country. We have, as it happens, it comes to us through PRI, through
unfortunately, that
Minnesota.
Unfortunately, around 7 o'clock at night, and usually you're...
And if when you're at low power, you can't hear it, that's right. Now, it is possible to hear CBC programs over the Internet. You know, if you had a computer and you had real audio, you can listen to
CBC.
But the reason that program went away is that program went away, and now they're not offering that program to stations. The same thing happened. There was a show we ran a long, long time ago that a lot of people liked, a science program called Quirks and Quarks.
I remember that.
And that show also, the same thing happened. That show actually went out of production, and I think that CBC is now doing some kind of science program again. But, you know, we can only offer programs if someone distributes them and offers them to us, and I think as far as CBC is concerned, as it happens, is it. That's all there is.
I see. Well, I think you're all doing a good job, and I enjoy your show. I'm fortunate. I have two stations, WBEZ up here in Chicago and WILL in the Champaign-Urbana, so I enjoy both of them.
Great. Well, thanks for the call.
Great. Thank you.
We appreciate it. And we have about 10 minutes left, you know, if you'd like to call in and talk with our guest, Renee Montaigne. You have questions about public radio. You have comments. You have something you'd like to pass on to her. Some thoughts about a show that you heard on an NPR show. Maybe you heard it here, but we didn't produce it. That is, it came from Washington. We get many of comments like that, and we do indeed try to either pass them on or to say, well, you can send emails, you can make a telephone call, that the folks there in Washington, they're very interested in what you think about the programs that you hear. And it's always nice to have someone call up and say, I heard something and I thought it was the greatest thing that I've ever heard. But it's maybe more common that people call up and say, how could you possibly do that sort of, it's unconscionable, I'm never going to give you another pay, you know, that kind of stuff. And, you know, that's cool, too. We're fine with that. We're happy to have comments, whatever way they go. Here's somebody else here locally. Champaign. It's line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm very glad to be able to speak to you. And because I have NPR on almost all the time during the day. One of the national people that I really like is Scott Simon. I think he's so insightful. And then you talked about the intimacy of radio. When somebody, one of the local announcers is missing, I begin to worry, like, oh, dear, they got a job somewhere else. So you really do get to know them and like them a lot. We had a fellow named Vince Duffy, and I understand he's now in Ohio because I've heard him a few times on the National. So
that's right. That was where he grew up, and there was a job open at Ohio State.
Uh-huh.
I'm remembering that right. So, yes, he's still in public radio, and he's out there in Ohio, he and his family. He has a whole flock of children.
Oh, well, and I also appreciate Craig Cohen, so he's a neat guy, too. Well, I had a question. You know, often you hear reporters interviewed who are from newspapers, you know, New York or Los Angeles, who are overseas somewhere. How do you get them to report for you for NPR? Are you paying them or?
A little. Not enough to report for us, though, I have to say. It goes back, it's a very time-honored thing at NPR. It goes back to when we really had no reporters in most of the world. And how did you get a story? Well, you either talked to a newsmaker, opinion maker, and hope they spoke English, and certain stories demanded that. But if you wanted a reporter-type story, we really had to turn to the Washington Post, the New York Times, the L.A. Times. So there have always been those relationships, as long as I can remember. And we still do that even though we have reporters in the field now. If a reporter from a newspaper has a special story that they got and it's their own private, you know, creation. They don't mostly, we won't go to someone who's, we don't ask, let's say you hear a New York Times reporter, we're not asking them to report a story for us. What we've done is either seen a story they've done that very morning or the day before, or we just know that they're where no one else that we have is and that they're reporting on the subject and that they'll, like if let's say a New York Times reporter was the first and only person into Kabul, you know, we would call them. So what's going on? It doesn't take much, I have to say, from their point of view. What it really takes is them to take what is often very precious time away from a deadline story to talk to us for often live on the air, 5 minutes. You know, in any event, it's always about a five-minute experience, two of which are devoted to getting the phone line in good enough shape to, you know, like jiggering it or recalling them back or something. But it's usually about a 5 or 8 minute experience for the reporter. And yet they, I don't know exactly what they pay them, but it's something like a nominal fee, like a almost an honorary, like $100 or something just for their time, really.
Uh-huh. I have one other question. A lot of times when you hear people ask questions in English, and then you hear a translator answer it, is there somebody also asking the question in that language?
Yeah, that is so good. That is such a little detail. It's so great that you picked it up. Yeah, I tell you what the thing is. Very long ago, again, we figured out that if you had somebody ask the question, translate the question, the person answer the question, and then the translation, you'd get one question in an entire story. So we sort of settled on a kind of a form, if you will, that seems natural, but to an astute listener will notice they're missing something. And the natural thing seems to be hear the question in English, hear sometimes like 30 seconds or even 10 or 12 seconds of the answer in the other language, that to indicate that there's, to first hear the voice. That's always really important, to hear the actual sound of the person speaking, but also to show that we're really there. And for anybody who speaks that language, to hear the first couple of words, which is an authenticating mechanism. I mean, you don't worry about it too much, but it just sort of authenticates the fact that they did start their sentence with, yes, I really believe that, or the bombs were falling, but I, you know, and then bring in the translation.
I understand.
And it's really just, as you can imagine, you would never have time to finish both up. But absolutely, 90% of the time, a question is asked in English, it's translated. And some of the time, rarely, but occasionally, someone does understand English perfectly well enough to understand your question. But it does not feel comfortable answering in English.
Yeah, I understand.
That happens, too.
I understand. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Right. We have great about question. 5 minutes left. So if there's someone who has a question, call right now, and we'll get you in before the show ends. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. This is a kind of question that I think interviewers probably hate. I wouldn't want to be asked it. Or reporters say, no. It's that question that says, you know, obviously you have had the opportunity to do lots and lots of different things. But if today we said, all right, we'll give you the time and the resources to do whatever story you want, something that you're dying in your heart of hearts to do. I mean, is there anything that right away you'd say, oh, yeah, I know what I would like to do?
You know, if you'd asked me that question 10 years ago, the most amazing story I ever covered, and I didn't cover it for 10 years, but over a several-year period, it was the experience in South Africa of that country, sort of the release of Mandela and that country finding its way and through some really rough and bloody times to a democracy and a multiracial society. You know, funny, partly because I do so many, so that at a different time I would have had a different answer. But all the resources and time and money in the world right now, you know, weird way, you couldn't pay me more, and you couldn't hardly give me more than I've got, you know, at NPR. I mean, I sometimes think I have the best job at NPR because I'm able to do so many things. You know, I'm able to host, but I don't have to keep up those Bob Edwards hours forever and ever, give up my life. I'm able to, you know, pretty much name the stories I do, and I'm finally moved over to doing a lot of interviews, which satisfy a part of me that was always there, but, you know, wouldn't have been ready to do a few years ago. I mean, I've been reporting really for 25 years, and I love reporting. And when I hosted All Things Considered for that couple of years, I left. A good chunk of the reason I left, not the only reason, but a lot of the reason I left was I wasn't ready to sit in a studio behind a mic like we're doing right now. I am ready to do that now, so which is why I like hosting Morning Edition. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't time in my life where I wanted out in the world. So you almost couldn't. On one hand, you couldn't almost give me anything more than I've got. Which, knock on wood, you know, that's kind of a scary point to be in because I feel like I'm inviting, you know, the gods to make something bad happen.
Well, the gods don't listen to the show. We have a couple of callers. We'll try to get at least one. This is a car phone here, line one. Hello.
Hi. I am an avid listener as much as possible, given the fact that I work full-time. But I have a question. Has anybody ever interviewed Tom and Ray Maliazzi from Car Talk? Because they're a scream.
Well, you know, I interview them for fundraisers. I host national fundraisers a couple times a year, and every other time, they are hysterical. You just say one question and off they go. No, but do you know that they started off, they always had their show in Boston, it was a local show, but they came to NPR and came to sort of national attention because they were on Susan Stamberg's version of what is now Leanne Hansen's Sunday morning edition, and they used to have a 5-minute segment. And so we had them on our air for a couple of years. And then
I think people might find it really interesting, and a lot of conversations I have with friends, they have a lot of my women friends listen to Car Talk and not as many of my men friends.
I think it's a kind of woman show. It's a philosophy show, of course. Well, anyway, the only other thing I'd say is that you get so much of them anyway on their show. I suppose, you know, what more is there to say? But I don't think it's anything in particular. Just that they are another show, so we tend not to interview our own people.
You know,
you tend not to bring on Scott on All Things Considered to ask him about himself. You know, because, you know, there he is on his own show. That'd be the only reason.
All right. Well, thank you.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I'm sure that Tom and Ray would be the first to admit that they are powerfully attractive to women. I'm certain of it. We'll try and get one more real quick here. Line two, Champagne. Hello.
Hi. I've got a quick question. In earlier times, when the news was full of things like Gary Condit and the scandal, O.J. Simpson and the scandal, and, you know, everybody and his uncle on TV is doing the scandal, how does NPR decide how much or whether to discuss the scandal du jour?
Let me give you about a minute.
Okay, gosh, do I have a minute? Well, let me tell you, it's talked about and talked about and talked about. We tend to err in the direction of not doing it. And we didn't go as far as Dan Rather that, you know, we didn't make a political statement and say, as he did on CBS, that I'm not going to cover Gary Condit, which seemed odd and out of context, I must say, for that particular news show. It never happened before. Probably won't happen again. I'm starting to talk fast. Mostly scandal is anathema to our shows. And the only way they get on is if we figure out some angle where it has some implications for society at large. And then at a certain point, when it's a big enough story, the idea is we try and do it in the most politest, you know, context, you know, within context way. This is best all I can say. I think so far it's been working, but for some listeners it's too much, and for others they feel like, what's our problem? We're missing some big important stories. Mostly with our listeners, the argument is you're doing too much of it. And then we think you're right. We're very sensitive to that. No, but none of us want to cover scandals just for the sake of covering scandals.
Well, we got to leave it at that because we've used the time. Thanks very much for being here.
You're welcome.
We appreciate it. Renee Montaigne from National Public Radio.